Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast still not sure what full fibre broadband is. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey Corey.
I'll tell you who does know what full fibre broadband is, Steve, and that's Boris Johnson.
Well,
he talked about it quite a bit during the election campaign, and we now have an idea of what it might be because we've had the decision on Huawei to provide 5G infrastructure, which was quite controversial. So we thought we'd have a bit of a look at it. This is recorded the week in which the broadband decision to award Huawei a contract has been made. So there's been a lot of news coverage over it. What I've not really seen, Steve, is actually people telling me what 5G is. What is 5G?
Yeah, it's quite common with most tech stuff, isn't it? This thing is going to be absolutely going to revolutionise the world, but no one can actually tell you what it is. 5G, put simply, is the next kind of wave or stage of internet connectivity. Effectively, what it does is it increases speeds, so you'll be able to download stuff, access things quicker, increases the ability to kind of like connect more stuff into the network so that you can have more, you know, there's the phrase Internet of Things where everything will be connected up to the internet one day so that you'll make your toast in the morning or pop out with a burnt in the shape of whatever the weather is for your area, all of that kind of thing. That's a genuine thing.
What?
Which exists.
Why?
It's God knows.
Why are people burning toast? And why would you burn toast with snow?
I don't know.
Surely just so many mixed metaphors.
But essentially, 5G is just the next stage of internet connectivity, which gives us more capacity. It's a bit like kind of like railways in a lot of ways. You can only have so many carriages or trains on the track at any given point. So what we're doing is we're building more lanes or building more lines to get things to connect to.
Okay, yeah. So I saw that. Yeah, it's definitely quicker. The explainer I saw was that the difference between 4G and 5G was you can access a page and it takes you 0.44 milliseconds with 4G. And it takes you 0.01 milliseconds with 5G, which, I mean, is still, they're both pretty quick, but I suppose if you've got stuff like driverless cars,
yeah,
it is quite important to have that speed.
So here's the thing. So like with things like driverless cars or kind of anything where you need connection constantly, absolutely very, very important. But even with humans engaging with things. So like if you kind of load up a website and it loads up even a few milliseconds slower than you might like, it has been shown that it decreases your likelihood to, say, make a purchase on that website. This is tracked and studied. It's one of the things I work with for a living. So even though it feels like it's, you know, completely unnoticeable in terms of how people might engage with it, actually these things can and do have an impact.
And so the Internet of Things, which I first saw as a thing, there was a Jeremy Corbyn meme on the Internet of Things.
Of course there was.
But one of the news articles I saw trying to tell me what 5G was said that it will allow you everything to be connected to the Wi-Fi. So yes, your toaster and your fridge and then your toothbrush will be connected to the Wi-Fi, and that means you'll be able to get reports on how well you've cleaned your teeth. So that makes it sound like some sort of totalitarian bastardry I don't want any part of whatsoever.
So like most technological innovations, absolutely there are some dark side potential for it.
Hashtag surveillance capitalism.
Yeah, but at the same time, you could make the exact same argument about radio or the printing press or whatever. All of these things have been abused by, you know, authoritarian, totalitarian governments in the past. But at the same time, they've also done an awful lot of good when used correctly. And 5G and the Internet of Things is just like that. Yes, it does potentially open up the capacity for abuse in various forms, which is why it needs to be regulated effectively. But equally, it does allow for some great potential benefits. So like the next, like there's one train of thought, which is that the next wave of healthcare kind of like revolutions isn't going to be from, you know, a specific new technology. It's basically going to be from just studying big data. And in order to study the big data, we have to collect that data. And the Internet of Things is one of the ways to do that, so that we can, you know, identify where the problems in diagnoses kind of like processes are. So that if we know that actually, if we get people with, say, a cancer diagnosis 2 weeks earlier, it increases their chances of survival and remission by X percent. We know that at that point, if these sorts of symptoms have been presented, we just need to tell doctors, get them off to for a diagnosis.
And the thing that 5G needs is a lot of cost and a lot of infrastructure.
Yeah.
So 3G and 4G is with cables, whereas 5G needs brand new infrastructure, almost pulling out the cables, putting in new things. Rolling out that new infrastructure is what the British government was deciding about last week, as you're listening to this. And Huawei, which is the global leader in 5G, it has 30% of the market share. It's a Chinese company. And Boris Johnson allowed Huawei to be part of Britain's 5G network. And that was capped at 35%. And also, Huawei, it will be kept away from sensitive things like nuclear weapons, that kind of thing. So yeah, they might be able to give you feedback on brushing your teeth, but they're not going to get access to our weapons.
No, yeah, and I think it kind of goes even further than that. I think it was even just things like hospitals as well, and things I think might have been on the list as well, as to kind of like areas they're not allowed to have access to. So
now that's caused a little bit of a kerfuffle, hasn't it? Partly in the Trump administration, but also in the Tory party as well, that we'll talk about. And one of the reasons for that is because of this worry about backdoor spying. Yep. That essentially leaving trapdoors for, that Huawei sets up a thing and leaves a massive trapdoor that the Chinese can come in and just take all of our data and all of our toothbrushes. And then they control all our toasters, and it'll pop up with the wrong weather.
Yeah.
Or maybe the picture of Chairman Mao's face, I don't know, or Xi Jinping.
Yeah, absolutely. Like without going into the intricacies of foreign policy and whether or not China would be likely to do that, because God only knows, I'm not qualified enough to make that statement. But backdoors and trapdoors within kind of like systems like this are a known thing. They can be created. You can exploit your way into them in various forms. But absolutely, if you are a global power and you have leverage with a company, you absolutely could lean on them to leave in some backdoors so that you can access it at a later point.
So there's an interesting case study of this that's from a really interesting BBC long read on Huawei from a year or two ago. We'll put it in the show notes. So the African Union HQ building, it was built in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. I hope I pronounced that correctly. And it was custom built. China gave $200 million to custom build this building. And so Le Monde Afrique, though, they, a couple of years after it was built, they said that the African Union's computer system at that building had been compromised, and the material from that building had been taken from there straight to Shanghai. Now, China denies the story, the African Union denies the story, but the paper stands by that story, and it says that anonymous sources it speaks to stand by the story that this computer system has been compromised. Now, the company that set out all the tech in the African Union HQ building was Huawei. And Danielle Cave, who's from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, she did a report looking at the African Union building. What she said was, doesn't mean that Huawei's complicit in this computer failure and the compromise of this computer system. What she does say, though, is it's hard to see how the company would be unaware that data theft was taken from this building for 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of depends on what the deal was. So if they were responsible for kind of like the upkeep of the IT and things like that, then absolutely. And in general, I'm inclined to agree that it seems unlikely that Huawei wouldn't be aware of this. So it does seem quite likely that Huawei probably is in some form assisting Chinese intelligence gathering operations.
It is at best an interesting coincidence, isn't it?
Yeah.
Especially when in China the Communist Party takes a shall we say a keen and close view on what companies can and cannot do.
Absolutely.
So all companies, I think, have to have Communist Party officials on their boards and making reports, that sort of thing. That
there's all kinds of weird and wonderful bits of regulation that you have to adhere to if you're even just running a business in China. I had to look this up recently for work, and some of it is just really odd.
What's the oddest thing that you found?
There's some very specific pieces of permits and things you need, which require you to kind of like be some definition of present in the country. So effectively having an office somewhere, but it's only you're only allowed, I think, in certain areas to host that office, depending on what it is you're doing. So it's like you have to have an office in, say, Shanghai or Beijing or something like that.
So there's a few wider political questions, aren't there?
Yeah.
That happened as a result of this kerfuffle. I suppose one of them is this idea of research and development and nationalising stuff like broadband 5G. There's an American report, actually, that an internal US government report that suggested that the US should nationalise 5G broadband and provide a company that does all of it in America. Now, you will be surprised, as I was, Steve, to hear that the Trump administration wasn't really down with nationalising stuff and 5G in particular.
Shocked.
But the reason why Huawei is the position it is, the reason it is this market leader, is because, well, one of the reasons anyway, it spends £20 billion on research and development every year. That's one of the biggest research and development budgets in the world. And obviously a lot of that is because it gets support for the Chinese government. It's also not a publicly listed company, which means they are not accountable to shareholders and so can plough more money in this business without looking for short-term profits.
Yep.
This is a bit of an odd one, isn't it? Because almost because there's been this lack of R&D spending in Britain for years, there isn't much alternative but to go to private firms. If it wasn't Huawei, it would have to be another firm, wouldn't it? It would have to be, say, Siemens, I think, or something, or Samsung. Or...
Name a well-known kind of electronics brand and you'll probably find out they're involved in this or have some capability in kind of building this sort of stuff. You're absolutely right that the failure to kind of invest in like R&D, the kind of the development of these new technologies, is something that's been lacking in the UK for quite a while. And this isn't just a lack of conservative investment, it's a lack of investment under Labour as well in a lot of ways, or at least maybe lacking in the potentially the right sort of in investment. So in the United States, there's a program called DARPA, which is essentially, it's for funding blue sky thinking technological projects. It's run by the Department of Defense, but not everything in it is kind of like, you know, has defense applications. The internet was funded by DARPA, at least initially, as a concept. And one of the things that we've never had really in the UK is that kind of program. We've never really necessarily had anybody that's kind of focused on that kind of blue sky thinking. We did have some advisors that were looking at that a little bit, like Steve Hilton, if you remember him, David Cameron's...
the guy who's now on Fox News?
Yeah. His thing for a bit was trying to kind of like bring in blue sky thinking to policy
John Burt, I suppose, for Tony Blair.
Yeah, but it never really seemed to kind of take off in the same kind of way as it has in the US with DARPA. That's not to say, broadly speaking, in the US it's a massive thing, but they've got a very significant and successful example. And that example is something that Dominic Cummings at the moment seems to be looking to emulate. There's been reports going around that he's looking to convince the government to basically set up a British version of DARPA in some form, so that they can invest in this kind of technological research area, so that you know, when it comes down to it, next time we need to move to 6G or whatever else, we've actually got some capability and understanding of it in internally in the UK, and rather than having to kind of like go out to private firms of you know, governments who may or may not have our best interests at heart a lot of the time.
I suppose maybe there is in the 60s, just thinking of other departments, it was to kind of coordinate maybe research, development, economic planning for the future. Harold Wilson set up the Department for Economic Affairs under George Brown in the 60s. And the idea of that department was to try and utilise this white heat of technology, as Wilson saw it. But it didn't really get off the ground. I suppose it became a bit of a sop to George Brown for not beating Wilson in the leadership.
Yeah.
And then George Brown was never the most sober of ministers. Given the limitations here, and given the dominance of Huawei in the market, I think it's quite difficult to see how the British government could have come to a different decision. Given that Huawei is also already part of our 4G network,
yeah.
My understanding is that we were going to have to tear up the 4G network that Huawei was in if we weren't going to let Huawei be part of the 5G network as well. So it's one of those things where, because it is a 10, 20 year problem, there's no good... So, like, you can't just really say no. If you were, you'd have to completely chuck away everything.
Yeah, quite likely, yeah. Which is one of the interesting things about kind of like the US's stance on this, is obviously the US does not want, as quite famously at this point made it quite clear, they did not want Huawei kind of like providing any infrastructure for the UK, primarily out of concerns for these backdoors and like data information leakages, all of that sort of stuff. But nobody's really raised a fuss around 4G, and nobody's even kind of mentioned that even if we, as you say, even if we didn't go with Huawei for 5G, that they've probably already got some access somewhere anyway. And what are we doing about that if it is a threat?
So, I mean, I suppose the reason why it's an issue now is that there now we are in a sort of trade cold war, aren't we?
Yes.
Between China and the US. So Meng Wanzhou, who is Huawei's chief financial officer and daughter of the founder of Huawei, was in court last week on sanctions busting charges because in Canada, I think, because of a US warrant that went out. So there's a big geopolitical thing going on at the moment. And it's something we've talked about already on podcasts this year, haven't we? That if we're looking at big global blocks and big global trade blocks, you've got the Chinese bloc on one side, you've got the American bloc on the other. Britain was in the European bloc, is now leaving that bloc. Oh, we wanted to be part of the American bloc. Well, there's some scathing quotes, as you say, from American senators. I think Tom Cotton said something like, the UK might be about to gain its sovereignty from the EU and cede it to Beijing. I mean, it's one of those things, I think, that shows the idea of national sovereignty is a bit of a myth for a country of our size. And always was like in the referendum in the 70s, they talked about pool sovereignty and the fact that actually we were dependent on other countries and at the whim of what other countries would do. In the 70s, that was very clear because of the oil price shock. There was a very tangible example of the impacts that a national government could have on the domestic economy.
Yeah.
And we've just sort of passed it by almost.
Yeah, absolutely.
If we come back to what you were saying about Cummings and DARPA, because that's interesting. What it seems like is Cummings, and particularly Johnson, are more interested in infrastructure than they are trade deals. So Johnson always seems to want to build bridges to wherever he runs at any particular moment. Looks like HS2 is going to be given the green light. Which we weren't sure about when we last recorded a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, in fact, I wrote a piece which is on the Patreon, kind of like looking at why it would be a bit politically foolish for them not to kind of like give the green light to HS2. So I can't say I'm surprised it's getting the green light. It makes sense for both, I think, from an economic and a political perspective for them.
If we think about the political issue for Boris Johnson, the issue for Boris Johnson is, with HS2, there's a lot of Tory constituencies, the Tory MPs, who are not going to be happy with this.
Yep.
Same with Huawei. So you've got people like Ian Duncan Smith, David Davis, who are not happy at the fact that Huawei's been given this role, who I would say are probably more Atlanticist in outlook.
Yeah.
But also are ones that will be looking for a US trade deal to provide those benefits that leaving the EU is meant to be having.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. We say with quote marks.
But it's also kind of important to note, you do have almost like some more, I suppose, I don't know if traditionalist is quite the right term, but a certain type of Tory who are kind of opposed to this just because they're not necessarily, there's a group of them who aren't Atlanticists, but are just generally concerned because of their interest in defence and things like that. So Tom Tugendhat.
It's not a real person.
Yeah, he is a real person.
He's called Tom Tugendhat, and it's not a real name.
And, God, what's his name? Johnny
Mercer?
Yeah, Johnny Mercer, former squaddy, if my memory serves me correctly. Tugendhat, I believe, is the chair of the Defence Select Committee?
Chair of Foreign Affairs.
Foreign Affairs.
He just won re-election.
Just won re-election, that was it. But yeah, he's got a very kind of like strong interest in these sorts of areas, and he is very much kind of like opposed to kind of like Huawei's involvement, but not necessarily for the exact same reasons as somebody like IDS and David Davis. So it's important to note that there are those two different factions, and it's entirely possible that some could be won over in a different way to some of the others. Like, I could imagine, like, Tugendhat could probably be won over more easily in a lot of ways, because you can basically say, no, here's all of the things we're doing to prevent, you know, mitigate the risk of, you know, data spying and all of that sort of stuff. Whilst IDS and David Davis as Atlanticists are much more likely to go, but we're annoying America, we need to keep America on side, and therefore vote against him if they came to it as a kind of like a political statement.
I think the other thing in terms of the... I mean, there are very legitimate concerns.
Absolutely.
Very, very legitimate. But the government essentially is painted into a bit of a corner.
Yeah.
But it also seems like they've gone with Huawei partly because it's the cheapest option. So they've gone for cheap and reliable.
The government has kind of like run out of manoeuvrability on this. So it does not surprise me they've gone with Huawei, even with a kind of a limited involvement, primarily because there wasn't really an alternative. At least not that that was cost effective.
I think what it also shows, just again touching on the foreign policy aspect, is just as with policy on Iran following more the EU line than the American line, this is also an area in which Britain's following the EU line on this. So in Germany at the moment, there's a similar debate going on. So the Greens are opposed to Huawei being part of the 5G network. The Social Democrats, with a minority partner in the governing coalition, are also opposed to Huawei. Angela Merkel is personally in favour as the CDU majority party in that coalition. Question is whether she's got enough political capital to try and force something through. Mm-hmm. But the EU itself, I think, came to a collective decision about Huawei. And again, a bit like Britain, came to this idea of limited involvement.
Yeah.
So again, you've got this weird position where Britain sees it trying to be a bit more of a bridge between America and Europe, but heading more the European line.
And again, there's a kind of like another bridge actually there, which is actually the bridge between the UK and China. One of the big kind of like talking points, or at least one of the talking points during the Brexit referendum, was, hey, why if by leaving the EU we can trade more with like other up and coming nations like China. Now, there's nothing stopping us doing that to begin with, but you know, that was a kind of like a talking point. And there has been under a couple of different Tory governments now, starting with David Cameron, this kind of push to try and build bridges between the UK and China. And it's possible that this could be seen as part of that as well.
Wasn't pig semen mentioned as part of that?
Yes.
I swear. Yeah,
there
was
something about that. I can't remember in what context.
I think that was what we were exporting to China.
Yeah, it was something daft like that, wasn't it? Effectively, we still want to try and keep the Chinese government sweet, and this is a nice way to do that, which actually gives us some benefits. And if we can mitigate the risks, why not?
Mm.
That I believe is probably what the government's thought process is.
And I think also in terms of, if just think about the politics of this, yeah, as well, for Johnson, it's quite useful for him to show he's not Trump's poodle.
Yeah.
Again, during the election campaign and afterwards, it's this idea that we're going to be dependent on America for a trade deal, colonial chicken, all this kind of stuff. And it's quite a useful win, a useful way of differentiating himself.
Yeah.
And Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, was over last week, had a press conference with Dominic Raab. And I mean, it was not as explosive as maybe you would have been led to believe by the briefing beforehand.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously kind of a difference between what you know, international allies are willing to kind of like put forward publicly and the conversations that go on privately behind closed doors. But
not with Donald Trump, there isn't.
No, but Pompeo knows what he's doing, even if we don't necessarily agree with him on a lot of it.
That's a bold claim.
He knows he's been involved with this sort of stuff for years. Like, he's not dumb enough to try and make a kind of like have a blazing argument in front of a podium.
I suppose Donald Trump is otherwise occupied, one might say,
yes,
at the moment as well. But I think it does show, I mean, this HS2 shows the problems that Boris Johnson might have, even with an 80-seat majority. Almost the fact that you've got that 80-seat majority, you can see possibly a group of rebellious Tories rebelling. I mean, we've already got the ERG, but you can see that group forming again. Obviously, lots of cohesion over getting that Brexit bill through, at least the initial leaving the EU stage. But if you see, it'd be interesting to see who rebels on Huawei and who rebels on HS2, say, and is that the nucleus of an awkward squad that forms over the next 4 or 5 years?
Absolutely, and because the thing is, Boris Johnson, as you said, is quite likes his infrastructure projects. Broadly speaking, correctly, the type he tends to focused on in the past, not necessarily the best, but he does like them. They're lasting legacies and landmarks. But the thing with infrastructure projects is everybody's in favour of infrastructure until they're asked to kind of like back a specific project, because once that happens, you can end up pissing somebody off effectively, because you know if you're building a railway line, it's going to go through somebody's backyard.
You mentioned our Patreon page, Steve.
Yeah, so we have a Patreon now, patreon.com/notenoughchampagne. Fling us a couple of quid a month and you will get access to exclusive content, early access to content that we're producing for general consumption. You can take part in some of the thriving debates which have been on there, HS2 in particular. Had a number of comments made underneath. But yeah, it's well worth the cost of a pint, couple of pints a month.
2 pints a month for £2. We're going to finish the podcast and work out where Steve's getting his drinks from. We have a website as well, which is notenoughchampagne.com. We have a Facebook page, facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. James Crown designed our logo. Dave Depper composed our theme tune. Our Twitter handle's @nochampagnepod. I'm @paperbackrioter.
I'm @acousticradical.
Happy plotting.
I never said what. Off.